Shalom, good morning. This is Radio Shalom coming to you through Planet FM 104.6. Welcome back, Rabbi Brent.
Thank you, John. Lovely to be with you again.
Well, I was completely confused and bamboozled by your introduction to the philosopher Emmanuel Levinas. So can you tell me in layman's language just what you've told me a minute ago?
Well, Emmanuel Levinas, as we discussed, has this revelation following his experience of the Holocaust, and in particular, one of his heroes of philosophy, Martin Heidegger, becoming a Nazi. And this pushes him to re-envision a tradition for philosophy. The term that keeps coming up is ethics as first philosophy. And what Levinas means by that is that the entirety of philosophy has been going off the track. It's been going down the wrong direction since the time of Aristotle, that the purpose of philosophy has been to discover the truth of the world, has been to discover what is the real nature of the world. And Levinas says that's not right. That's not what we should be doing with philosophy. Rather than pursuing truth with philosophy, our first purpose, the first philosophy, should be ethics and how we relate to our world, what our behavior and our actions should be in our world to make our world a better place. In a sense, yes, absolutely, in a sense.
So how did he go about that?
Well, there's a description in Levinas of this polemic that exists between Athens and Jerusalem, between the world of the West and the Jewish world. The world of the West being the world that's focused on truth, that's focused on philosophy, and the world of Jerusalem that speaks about morality and ethics through the lens of biblical language. If I could just share a passage here that's a little bit more descriptive of what Levinas exactly means. This comes from one of his Talmudic commentaries, The Temptation of Temptation. The temptation of temptation may well describe the condition of Western man. In the first place, it describes his moral attitudes. He is for an open life, eager to try everything, to experience everything, in a hurry to live, impatient to feel. In this respect, we Jews all try to be Westerners. Just as Gaston Blanchard tried to be a rationalist, Ulysses' life, despite its misfortunes, seems to be to us marvelous, and that of Don Juan enviable, despite its tragic end. One must be rich and a spendthrift and multiple before being essential and one. With what conviction did Mr. Amar utter the words to enter history this morning? Oh, above all, we cannot close ourselves off to any possibility. We cannot let life pass us by. We must enter history and all the traps it sets for the pure, supreme duty, without which no feat has any value. There would be no glory in triumphing in innocence. A concept defined purely negative as a lack, associated with naivety and childhood, marked by a provisional slate. But it is forbidden to seek another antithesis to the temptation of temptation. Let us venture forth and understand. What Levinas is saying here, what he's telling us, is that the Western mentality, the mentality of rationalism, is to seek and to acquire and to consume the material that we find in our world to benefit ourselves. That we're tempted by luxuries, that we're tempted by food, that we're tempted by new ideas and new thoughts, and that this pursuit of cognition, this pursuit of understanding, distracts us and takes us away from what he says means to be essential and one, to be present in the moment with another person and to engage in real interaction with them. Part of this stems from the radical way in which Levinas sees and relates to other people. For Levinas, another person with their own frailty, with their own needs, is actually imposing an ethical imperative on us so that we must respond to them by caring for them, by serving them, by surrendering our own possessions for them, by feeding them. We actually are compelled, when we're in this ideal relationship with another person, which Levinas calls the face-to-face relationship, to sacrifice our own being, our own material, to see that the other person thrives.
So that is more or less making us, each one of us individually, responsible for others.
It's making me responsible for you and responsible for well-being. Every person that I encounter.
For their well-being.
Correct.
Or for the whole thing.
Well, we have to respect them as another person completely unto themselves, an infinity existing beyond the totality of everything we can understand in the world, and that other person in a way is sacred, and to cognitively seek to conceptualize them, to understand them, is, as I mentioned before, a violent act. Because sitting across from you, Joan, as I see you, if I were to say, well, Joan is the host of Radio Shalom, Shalom Radio, then I don't capture the fullness of who Joan is. I only see this one aspect of you. I disembody and deconstruct the totality of what you are. Doing such, even as saying that, in a form of possession, like if I were to speak about my wife, Levinas would have a problem with that. He would say, that woman, that wonderful woman, she's not only your wife, she's much, much more than that. And when you bring her into a concept like that, you, in a way, destroy the whole being that she is.
The totality.
Exactly.
So does anybody ever understand the totality of somebody else? Because
no.
You only see the parts that they expose to you.
There's, as I said, the language is poetic, the way that he uses it. To engage with another person in the most upright and honest way is to see them face to face. And the face completely evades comprehension, so that if you understand anything of another person, you've lost the sense of their face. You can't grasp at their face. Their face evades and leaves only a trace that we can see.
So how deeply do you go in seeing the totality? Because, again, you can only see what they expose.
And that's a good question. When do we see the totality? And I think Levinas would say that most of the time we don't. And that's the problem that leads to all sorts of violence in the world, that leads to homicide, to genocide, that leads to theft. It's that failure to respect and concern ourselves with how the other person's well-being is not merely something that needs to be respected and granted, it's something that I'm actually obligated to respond to and to help to ensure.
So he's trying to build a better world through more empathy and understanding. No wonder it attracted you. But how does he go about it?
Well,
You know, most philosophers have disciples or something like that. Does he have followers?
Well, he's got me, and he's got, I'm sure, several hundred, if not thousand, people around the world that are fascinated by his work. And as I mentioned before, he's been profoundly influential on other great philosophers whose names are more well known to your listeners, I'm sure. People like Sartre, people like Camus and like Derrida, who see within his philosophy clues about flaws within prior systems and how they develop their own systems to overcome those flaws. In a practical aspect, just to use some of Levinas's language, as we get deeper and deeper into it, it makes more and more sense.
As long as you use simple words.
Well, so let's go through and let's decode the words as we go.
Okay.
The epiphany of the absolutely other. The epiphany of someone else, another person, whom is a complete world unto themselves, infinite beyond our comprehension, someone who we can't comprehend, is a face by which the other challenges and commands me through his nakedness. The other person's vulnerable. They're exposed. They are dependent and reliant on us for their own security, is what Levinas is saying here. The other challenges me from his humility and from his height. He sees but remains invisible, thus absolving himself from the relation that he enters and remaining absolute. The absolutely other is the human other, and the putting into question of the same by the other is a summons to respond. When we conceptually understand the other person as being the same, that's violence, and it requires a response. The I is not simply conscious of this necessity to respond, as if it were a matter of an obligation or a duty about which a decision could be made. Rather, the I, by its very position, responsibility through and through. The mere fact that you are another person, that you are a totality into yourself, that you are naked, that you are vulnerable, means that I have an obligation to respond. Your being, your otherness, commands me with its humility, with its vulnerability, and imposes on me at the same time a need to respond as you stand at a height morally above me.
What if the other is violent and hasn't got humility and is aggressive? You still have to adopt the sight of seeing them as vulnerable and open?
Well, I think Levinas is speaking to that person who is violent in telling them that they're misinformed about the way that they're interacting in the world. And something that Levinas argues in one of his early works of his philosophy called Time and the Other is that for a person who behaves as though they're the only person in the world, for a person who lives in what he calls solipsism, they have no future. There's a recognition that if I am isolated to my own consciousness, if I'm an island unto myself, I'm vulnerable. We all need to eat. We all need to consume. We're all going to eventually die, and death brings an end to existence. Levinas's really incredible realization in Time and the Other is that immortality, in a way, can be achieved when we don't adopt that aggressive stance towards other people, where instead we can recognize that because I protect your dignity as being a completely other person, even if I die, something else will exist. And if, in a way, I can meet you and have that relationship face to face, that brings with it the opportunity to live on and to have an impact in the future. It's a really appealing idea for me, and it corresponds to a lot of my understanding of what the Jewish doctrine of immortality means as it can be understood rationally. You know, when I'm asked by individuals about what comes after life, what is the afterlife, what does it mean to be in heaven, to live forever? On the one hand, I don't know. I mean, I've never been to heaven or hell, for that matter. I've never been back to tell you about it or to talk about it. But what I can say is that we have an opportunity in this life to create in this world a heaven or a hell, depending on how we behave. And when we conduct ourselves and behave in an ethical and moral manner, we have an opportunity to influence and to create that world. And more than that, our deeds, as they're carried on by our students and by our children and by latter generations, they provide for us a sense of immortality. In the same way that Levinas says that the only way that any person can have a future is through the other.
So that's where the infinity comes in.
Yeah. The other is infinite. Infinite meaning that it's beyond my ability to comprehend, right? We're talking about consciousness and comprehension.
So I like the title, sort of totality to infinity, so that you've explained the totality thing. So now it was the infinity. So I understand that how you influence and what you've done in your lifetime does carry on because others pass on what you've passed on to them.
Yep.
Is that right?
That's right. You've got it. But the recognition of the other as being so vulnerable is really something that I find appealing, and that, as we can hear, it's built through not a religious system, but a system of philosophy that builds, you know, complex terms, but uses terms nonetheless that don't require any sort of maxim for their existence.
But if you see the other as vulnerable, then you have to recognize that the other sees you as vulnerable too.
Perhaps, but I can't comprehend what the other is comprehending. We're trapped in our own consciousness. This is the problem of alterity, as is explained by Levinas. Here's a little bit from Time and the Other, the work I just mentioned. In the very heart of the relationship with the other that characterizes our social life, alterity appears as a non-reciprocal relationship. It only goes one way. Alterity is about the way I view you, and it can't be about the way that you view me, as you just attempted to get there. That is, as contrasting strongly with contemporaneousness, not that we're existing together in this world, that the only way I can experience this world, as we learn through Husserl, is through my own consciousness, through acts of consciousness that emanate through myself. The other as other is not only an alter ego. The other is what I myself am not. The other is this not because of the other's character or physiognomy or psychology, but because of the other's very alterity, the other's otherness. The other is, for example, the weak, the poor, the widow, and the orphan, whereas I am the rich and the powerful.
I'm not sure about that. I think that always makes you feel in a superior position if you view yourself as rich and powerful and the other as depending on you. It's a certain amount of dependence, and nobody likes to feel that. So if you send that message to the other, they won't be very happy about it.
Well, in situations, the language being as strong as it is, will certainly fall beyond our ability to relate to it. But Levinas uses this explosive language with a very acute purpose of being able to convey the importance of viewing the world in this way, that if we, rather than not seeing ourselves as powerful and strong, but if we see ourselves as weak and vulnerable and perhaps able to go out of existence at any moment, it means that we can only live within a psychology of survival, that our survival is all that's important. And this was the problem with Heidegger, right? Because my survival is the only true thing that matters in this world. Because when I cease to survive, the world ceases to exist. Everything that I encounter has to serve for my own existence. And this, for Levinas, is the profound issue. That when we see another person as someone who we need to serve and respect, as someone who commands us to engage with ethically, then we avoid destroying that other world. Then we avoid locking ourselves in the isolation of solipsism, of where the end of existence is our own death.
Self-absorption.
Yes, this is not necessarily language that we'd use on the street with each other. There is some profound truth in it. There's a novel called Life and Faith, which was profoundly influential upon Levinas in formulating this idea. The novel's by Vasily Grossman, who was a Jewish soldier in the Russian military. His book actually had to be smuggled out of Russia because of it being banned by the government there. And in this novel, he describes the siege of Leningrad, in that the Germans ruled ruthlessly over the Russians at the time that they occupied the city. And then when the Germans fell, there was this outpouring, visceral reaction, really vitriol on the part of the Russians who were trying to put their lives together. And they forced the Germans to do manual labor and clean up the city as they made a mess of it. One of these experiences, it's gruesome, I'll warn your listeners, was that the Germans had used a military bunker to store dead bodies. And so when the Russians came in, they forced the Germans to go and clear out this bunker. And a group of Russians are described by Grossman as surrounding these soldiers, watching them go in and out of the bunker and carrying bodies out. And they're looking for their missing relatives. And they're wondering if maybe, you know, one of them is among the dead individuals that are coming out of this bunker. And it's in this moment that Grossman describes a woman in the crowd. And the woman in the crowd is looking for her daughter. The German soldiers have gone to the bunker, and they emerge out carrying the body of a young girl. And the woman in the crowd starts to cry out, "My daughter, my daughter!" And all the people around her look and realize this isn't even her daughter. But her reaction is so emotional that everyone's frozen in time and they don't even really know what to do. And everyone stops, even the German soldiers. And there's this one soldier, the only one who seems really affected at all by what's going on. He's wearing a handkerchief over his nose so to cover the smell that, you know, had to obviously be horrendous. This woman, as she approaches this soldier, picks up a stone. And she's clenching the stone, and everyone's waiting for a violent moment to erupt where she's going to take the stone and hurl it at this one soldier. And at the very last moment, she drops the stone, She reaches into her overcoat, into her pocket, and she pulls out a scrap of bread. She takes it up to the officer and she says, "Here, take the bread out of my mouth." Levinas speaks about this story being told in Grossman as an example of inexplicable goodness. That when we truly engage with other people, we're commanded to care for them. We're commanded to give of ourselves. "Here, take the bread from out of my mouth. Take this bread that I need to eat, or else I'm going to go hungry, and eat it yourself, because I can see that you're vulnerable." And you think about the situation, the little woman interacting with the soldier, actually, someone trained in combat. And who then is the weak and who is the powerful?
Well, he was a prisoner of war, so he couldn't have been very powerful.
I've still got a skeptic across from me. That's fine.
I'm interested in his Talmudic writings that he was influenced by. In what way he was influenced?
You know, this is an interesting feature of Levinas's biography, that although he had studied sort of rudimentary Hebrew, as we would in Haider today, actually, Jewish life wasn't something that was a focus of his for most of his life. And it was only after World War II that a very enigmatic figure named Monsieur Shoshani, we know very little about. He's from somewhere in Eastern Europe. He lost his family in the Holocaust and was one of these people, these yeshiva bochers, that had an amazing mind. And Shoshani studied with two figures we know of for very long times. The other one happens to be Elie Wiesel and Emmanuel Levinas. And he lived with Emmanuel Levinas in an upstairs apartment from their house for some years. And Levinas every day would discover Talmud with him, so that a whole world of Talmud opened up. What happened to Shoshani is rather interesting. He when he passed away, was in South America and buried in a grave there. The grave was paid for by Elie Wiesel, so still no one really knows anything about this Talmudic master's family. But in a sense, the way that Shoshani taught Levinas and Wiesel to approach the Talmudic text was an inspiration for them. And Levinas would give a closing lecture at the annual meetings of the French Society of Jewish Intellectuals every year. And a number of those readings have been preserved and saved, in which he attempts to translate the text of the Talmud for Western ears. He attempts to take that language and turn it into something that is comprehensible and valuable for those who study Western humanities. Doing such, what comes out is actually something very similar to what comes from his philosophy, the moral, ethical lessons. And they're wonderful to explore. There's a collection that's just been translated a few years back by Annette Aronowitz called Nine Talmudic Readings. There's another one for Talmudic readings that's worthwhile too, but we'll have to leave that for another time.
I was going to say, well, that gives us a first for another time. Thank you very much, Rabbi, and thank you for listening. Don't forget to listen next Sunday at 10 past 10. And if you've missed this program, go to www.planetaudio.org.nz/radioshalom.